This interview with Gordon Pack was recorded on February 28, 2023, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
Okay, obviously my name is Gordon Pack, but since, I guess, 86, when I became Muslim, everybody called me Abdullah. So they always say Abdullah Gordon Pack. Anybody did significant time in Maryland's prison system is going to know me. I went to prison in 79 as a 15-year-old for rape, kidnapping, and armed robbery charges. I was adjudicated as an adult. And the funny thing about that is, and we'll get to that, is I've been doing a lot of lobbying for the Youth Equity and Safety Act. And what it is, it's a bill they're trying to pass that modified the existing law that came into effect in 1994. What they did, when I got arrested, you could only be tried as an adult if the penalty for the crime that you committed was life or death. In 1994, they changed that. Now, if you're over the age of 13 and you commit a crime that's considered a violent crime for an adult, you can be automatically charged as an adult and go through adjudication in the adult system. And that has been resulting in a lot of disparity, whereas more Black and brown kids are getting locked up from urban areas going into the adult system. So I've been lobbying to try to help to get the legislature to try to change their policy. Instead of letting them be automatically sent to the adult system, let us start in the juvenile system with people who have some type of clinical background and they're better qualified to make their decisions, because police officers do not have that type of background. They just lock you up because you committed the crime. And in most cases, when we, because I put myself in it, when we get in these situations, we don't fare well. You know, most of them don't fare well because the adult criminal justice system doesn't provide the same protection and rehabilitation services as the juvenile justice system. And it just seemed like they're just throwing people to the wind, and it's not making a difference because kids are still committing these violent crimes. It hasn't deteriorated, hasn't diminished at all. So that's one of the issues I was working on. So back to me. I get arrested at 15. Matter of fact, they didn't call it arrest. They detained me at 15. Didn't read my Miranda rights. All right, in the police station, asked me all of these questions, took all the evidence, my clothes, and then released me to the care of my father. About 8 hours later, when I'm supposed to begin high school for the first time, ninth grade, an arrest warrant was issued for me as an adult. So the police, two police cars came and raided the house, stopped the bus, boarded the bus in search of me. I saw them, so I wouldn't hide in the woods because I seen what was going on. And it went to my homeroom class at the high school. And at that point, my life was really pretty much over. I ended up pleading guilty. I was sentenced to life. I end up doing 42 years, 10 months, and 5 days before I was released. I had 16 parole hearings. 9 before the Patuxent Board of Review and 7 before the Maryland Parole Commission. And what happened 2 years ago, the Maryland legislature created this bill or this law called the Juvenile Restoration Act. And what it did, because the parole commission was underfunctioning and the governor wasn't playing fair because he had to approve anybody for parole, they said any kid that went to prison under the age of 18 that has served over 20 years could request a modification. And it got identified a criteria that the courts had to consider to determine whether or not they're going to give them that modification. And fortunately for me, the judge released me. You know, the judge released me. So that's pretty much my situation in a nutshell. So the stuff in between, we can get to that, but that's who I am. I'm a returning citizen. I did all of this time and now I'm out. I'm in a trend. I mean, I only been out like 3 months. Yeah, I came out November 14th. Yeah, 3 months. But I have a job for a nonprofit as a parole advocate, which is just lovely for me because I was doing this stuff on the inside before I got out. Now I have greater resources at my disposal. And now I get to talk to the parole commissioners one-on-one. You know, at first I couldn't do it, but I'm as an equal, not as an inmate. And so it's a real different or unique setup. One in particular still acts kind of stuck up, for lack of a better word. She doesn't respect the fact that the court let me out as opposed to the parole commission letting me out. So to her, it's like a slap in the face, but that's her issue, not mine. I'm out now, so we got to deal with it some kind of way. I'm in a transition program. I opted to, I think Shanice, she's the outreach coordinator for the public defender's office. She said, if you're really interested in reentry services, if this is something you really want to do, you should take the opportunity to work your way through one of the existing programs. This way you can learn what works, what doesn't work. You can plug into the resources and that'll help you out. So listening to her, which was a real good idea, but for another reason, I'm in Time Organization's transition program. And what that is they have a program targeting the guys that's being released, juveniles that did over 20 years in prison. They place us in these transition homes. Like where I'm at now, we have six of us total, two of us to a bedroom, three floor house, better than a prison cell, but we pretty much take care of ourselves. We don't have anyone, I guess, chaperoning us, for lack of a better word, but they send a vehicle to pick us up every morning to go to the main time center for a mental health group and substance abuse group and peer recovery. So Monday through Friday, we have to stay there from like 8 to 11. But after that, if we don't have like individual counseling with our mental health coach or our case manager, we're free to do what we want to do. So it's a really pretty good setup. And a lot of tools and resources are centralized there. So we get a lot of things done. So, and again, it's a trial and error type situation for me because reentry is real big for me. But what I'm learning, or what I learned, is that when you get out and you've been away so long as a kid, you really don't know what you need. You know, people just assume that you're an adult now, so you're familiar with opening a bank account, using the kiosk machine, using one of the card monitors, like a debit card thing. You don't know anything about that. When we first went out, five of us went to the Social Service Administration to get food stamps and any type of financial services that was available. And we didn't know what to ask for. They just dropped us off. So we go into Social Service. Hey, what are you here for? Food stamps, financial assistance. She said, no, what you first have to do is register. Gave me a little ticket, all of us, and told us to sit in the waiting room until they call us. So we're like, okay, what's the problem? But nobody ever explained that we needed a cell phone, we needed an email address, and we needed to know how to use an automated computer system. So when we went in there, we crashed the entire system because we didn't know what we were doing. And as a result of that, the lady who was in there, she got the cussing and fussing, and it made some of us kind of, I guess, anxious because we weren't used to this type of situation. We felt stupid as we were because we didn't know what we were doing. But having her get upset and somebody had to come in and replace her so she could step out and take a break just really went havoc on our nerves and how we thought. So as a result of that, we took it back to the administration at the time organization and said, look, this was the problem. This is what we went through. And as a result of them hearing that, they start developing better programs. So what they did, they hired a DHS agent to walk guys through after that point, those initial appointments, to be there and tell us what we needed and work us through it. But it's a trial and error type thing because we really don't know what we need. And they just assume we do. So when problems come up, we take it to them and they address it and make things better for the next group. But yeah, it's a whole lot of little stories like that. Going out to a nice fancy restaurant, not knowing that toilets have sensors in them. So one of my friends, true story, went in there, he had to use the bathroom, sat on the toilet. He didn't know as soon as the pressure changed in the toilet, it automatically flushed. So for him, it scared him. He jumped up and ran out of the store because it scared him. He wasn't used to it. But these are the things that I'm experiencing, we're experiencing, we're trying to help one another work through. But again, that's just some of the stuff that's just amazing. It's really amazing. It is. And every day is a great day. I really enjoy every day. Even the situation with mom, the worst day out here is better than the best day on the inside. That's how I look at it. So I'll gladly take these problems. So, all right. But let me stop there because I'll keep talking. I love to talk. I really love to talk. Very community oriented type person. So, yeah.
Those are some great stories to start off with. We love to have those. We kind of, how the workshop works is we interview you and then we kind of edit as a group. And so we're always telling the fellows, you know, look for stories, and you've got some great ones already. Just so we have it for the tape, what was the time on your original sentence?
Life. I was a lifer. Yeah. Life with parole. I became eligible for parole in 1992. Unfortunately, 2 years later, Governor Glendinning came up with this infamous life means life position. And for 25 years, not a single parole eligible lifer has made parole. Not one in 25 years. It messed up the whole prison system. But fortunately, legal avenues and lobbying and stuff, they made some changes. So people are starting to trickle their way out, you know, through the courts or even through parole.
And you were 15. And what year was that?
1979.
I can imagine. Yes. The computers would be quite a new thing then.
Yes, 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 yes.
So from all those stories, fellows, does anybody have a question for Mr. Peck?
Lucas, there is a question from Clara on chat.
Oh, great. Clara, would you like to ask it or would you rather I read it out? Just give me a thumbs up if you'd like me to ask.
Actually, I can do it. I'm in a place where I can speak now. Sorry. Okay. My question is, I know you mentioned earlier that you pleaded guilty yes. when you were first charged. My question has to do with, did you actually commit those crimes or did you plead guilty out of just naivete at a young age?
I actually committed the crimes. And I didn't plead guilty because I committed the crimes. I pled guilty because my parents was suffering so much through this whole process that when the attorney presented that idea to them, they told me it was the best thing to do. They still were in debt and was going through so much hardship, they just wanted to get it over. In hindsight, I regret having pled guilty because once you plead guilty, you waive your rights to so many things. So it's not a thing where I feel like I wasn't guilty. That's not the issue. The issue is being stuck in here for so long and not having any avenues to get out because I pled guilty. And people, even adults, have committed similar or worse crimes and got less time. And they're getting out and I'm still stuck in here. So that's the only regret I have. Now, I'm guilty. I'm really sorry for what I've done. In fact, another story. I was in Patuxent Institution years ago when rehabilitation was a big thing. For 11 years, I had a psychotherapy group once a month, once a week, tier counseling and individual therapy, remedial treatment programs like anger management, sexual things treatment, a whole lot of different programs. But it was a particular incident where a new staff member came on board our treatment staff, and we didn't know her from Adam and Eve, but everybody was calling her, what was her name? Dr. Claire Gilbert or Miss Gilbert. And the issue came up in discussion in one of the groups. Why is it that we can meet somebody for the first time and give them the respect of calling her Miss or Mrs.? And when we refer to the victims of our crime, we just say the victims. So from that day forward, I always refer to my victim as Miss Fowler. You know, because I felt at least that's the least I owed her. So that's something I always, even in my job now, profession, when people write their life stories, I say, man, you need to mention the victim by name. You know, you need to place a face and association, accept the shame and accept the guilt that goes with it because you actually committed the crime. So you have to really fess up to that. Sometimes we get in these situations, we lose sight of that and just focus on ourselves. And as a result, we feel like we're the victims. Like this situation with the life of policy, life means life policy. You know, that was hard for a lot of people really, really messed up. Some have died, but they have really, really messed up. And now they're not going to get an opportunity to get out because they lost hope. So keeping it relative, thinking about what you've done, accepting responsibility for it, makes this situation a little more easier to bear. And it makes you want to change and work on yourself. So that was just a story I wanted to share for that because it's relevant. You know, I'm big on victim awareness, very big on that. Does that answer your question, Clara?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Welcome.
All right. Somebody else want to hop in there with another question?
Hello, my name is Destiny. What was your childhood like?
Ooh. I was the oldest of three siblings. Initially coming up, my father was, I guess, third generation military. He was in the Air Force. He also was a third generation pastor of the family church when he got out the military. Me being the firstborn son, I was kind of arrogant and obnoxious. I really, really was starting off as a kid, but I went through a real bad traumatic experience. And as a kid, and I'll share because I always talk about these things and it may benefit other people. As a kid, we was like latchkey kids. My parents would always say, don't go out of the house until one of us get home from work. Well, they had this game back in the day, and some of you may remember it or be familiar with it. It's like called like 7-Eleven or Humpty Dumpty. There's different names for it, where the guys chase the girls, the boys chase the girls. If you catch the girls, you get to kiss them and dry hump on all that type of stuff. But anyway, here I am, 7 years old. Girls in my class, we all in the same little neighborhood, come to the back door. Three of them, Tammy, Nettie, and Cannon, come to the back door and tell me come out and play. Now, as a kid, I know I wasn't supposed to go out there, but I couldn't resist. One guy, three girls, I couldn't lose at this game. And I had like an hour or so before my parents came in. So I snuck out of the house and went out there and started playing the game, enjoying myself immensely. What I didn't anticipate was some older junior high school girls from the neighborhood stumbling upon us playing, and the dynamics of the game changed. And it kind of like scarred me because now everybody started chasing me. And the dynamics changed to the point that it scared me because I didn't know what to expect. Hindsight, I should just roll with it because it was nice. But at the particular time, I was just afraid. And they end up emasculating me, molesting me. They end up throwing me on the ground, pulling my clothes off, and fighting and all the other stuff, trying to get away, and I can't. But basically, they scarred me because they told me I wasn't a man. Men don't cry. Men are supposed to know what they're supposed to do. Nobody wanted me. And here I am, a seven-year-old. So because I snuck out, I felt like that was my fault and I couldn't tell my parents about it because they would punish me for sneaking out. So now I'm like jammed up. So my parents moved shortly thereafter. Complex. I got teased at church, teased at school. I got teased at the bus stop, in the grocery store. Kids are just cruel. They found a weakness to make up for this guy that was doing all this old crazy stuff to him. And they just picked and picked and picked. And it gave me a real deep-rooted complex. So my parents end up moving to California. We was in Anne Arundel County. We moved to California. So for years, that wasn't an issue for me. I just got involved in church, did well in school. That wasn't an issue. But 7 years later, my parents returned to the same neighborhood and the same house, and I did not want to be there. And what ended up happening in my mind, I thought everybody saw me as that same little insecure crying kid. And then actually I was, but I just thought they saw me that way. And it became a big issue for me because I developed these abnormal apprehensions about my sexual performance. I was a virgin. I was down there. I didn't want people to see me the same way. And what ended up happening, a girlfriend of mine, who were one of the girls who participated in this game, we were small, she confronted me about being scared and being a virgin, and gave me an opportunity, the option to go up to her room and we can have sex, or I could leave. And because I panicked and I was worrying about her because her experience, that she was going to tell everybody that I was a lying virgin, I still was a little kid, I had a little penis and all that, I got afraid. So I ended up breaking up with her. And by me breaking up with her, that meant I had to stay home because I couldn't hang out on the street anymore because I think she's going to put the word out. My father, who at this time was a flourishing minister at one time, got involved in drugs and alcohol as soon as we moved back down to the area, and it just became a disaster. He felt like I was acting gay, And his way of remedying that problem was to, he was drunk at the time, was dragging me to the kitchen, pulling out a stack of porn magazines. I never knew he had a briefcase in there. I would have been found if I knew he was in the house, but I had no idea. And his thing is, put it all on the kitchen table and told me to figure out what's wrong with me because his son ain't coming up being gay. Now, I felt insulted because I wasn't gay, but I was just hurt because he thought I was gay and I had to figure out a solution. So within 3 days later, I went out and committed my crime. So, and that was the essence of the whole root of my particular issue, my insecurity, my normal, concerns about my sexual performance, not measuring up, not fitting in. So in my mind, I rationalized it'd be safer and easier for me to go out here and assault and experience a person I would never see again, that I had control of that situation, and take a chance to, I guess, have sex with one of the girls in the neighborhood who would go and blab all of my business if I didn't meet up to the standards. And it was real stupid thinking as a kid, but that's how I thought as a 14, 15 year old. You know, and that really led to me going to prison. And then it took years for me to even address those issues because prison is not a place where you expose vulnerabilities. So therapy treatment really helped me. And what one incident, another story, it was this big old guy named Ronald Brody. Brute. Everybody was terrified of this guy in prison. He was sharing a story in tier counseling one day. Very vulnerable story, something you wouldn't expect to hear people say. Yeah. And he was sharing a story, and it was a story about him being molested, right, by his parents. And he was crying about this particular thing. So when I seen this big guy that everybody afraid of crying and revealing intimate stuff like that, that gave me a license to indulge in therapy. And he was my motivation. Just that one little incident, seeing, because in prison, you don't do things like that. But when I seen this big burly guy do it, I said, man, if he can do it, I can do it. And it got me involved in therapy. And I started taking it seriously. And I started really getting involved working on my particular issues. So that was really, really good for me, because had not that happened, I don't think I ever would have addressed those issues, at least not during those early years. But yeah, real tough, tough situation.
Mark, I knew you had a question there in the chat. Would you like to ask it?
Sure, I can ask it. Hi, Mr. Gordon. My name is Mark. I've been listening to your interview really closely, and I wanted to know about your last question. You said you were talking about how your father did all that stuff with the magazines and everything. So I wanted to know, would you say that he had a part of you, a part in you doing that crime that you committed 3 days later?
I would say my father ended up becoming a worse person after my arrest, because he kind of blamed himself. He blamed himself. And my mom witnessed that too, because he left me at the table in the kitchen with all this stuff and rolled out, and he fell asleep drunk. My mother came and put all them little magazines, very embarrassed, put all them little magazines back in the brief and told me just leave. But he always felt that if he hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have got locked up. So in some respects, to a certain degree, that incident may have pushed it a little sooner. It may have pushed it a little sooner. It made me feel a little more desperate to try to resolve the issue. But I think the root of the matter was I was just a coward. I was scared, and I didn't take a chance on doing something that was natural, because in hindsight, what did I really have to lose? You know? So I didn't measure up. I still would be fun, wouldn't it? So, but as a kid, I couldn't see that. So yeah, it's kind of hard to, yeah. But I do think that incident with Dad, the confrontation with Candy, the girlfriend, I think those things did contribute to that, and the sexual assault I incurred when I was younger. I think all of those things did have an impact on why I chose to act out the way I did. That's good, Mark?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what was going through your mind at 15 when you got your sentence? I mean, I can't imagine what that was like.
If I place myself back, the whole time I was going to court, and this came up at my modification hearing as well. When you're a kid, you really don't understand what's taking place in that system. For the most part, The only dialogue I had was like, yes or no. I didn't say anything more because I was intimidated by the whole process. I felt like other people really controlling, dictating things. I didn't understand everything that was involved. My attorneys really represented my parents, not me, because they were paying him. And that's what he went to talk to, not me. So when it got to the issue where I got sentenced, in my mind, I already knew that was a possibility, but I didn't believe it would happen because the lawyer told me, Kenneth Thompson, I remember his name to this day. He told me, said, man, chances are you're only going to get like 30, 40 years and they're going to send you to Patuxent and you'll get out while you're still in your early 20s. So he sold that particular idea, but the judge did something different. And I understand why he did something different. But when I got sentenced, I was just shocked. I was really numb because I didn't anticipate getting that sentence. And I didn't really understand what it entailed until I got back and started learning about other lifers. So I was really, really, really numb. Then I went through my resentment stage, became very rebellious. Now I'm going to the adult system, not just detention system, but adult prison facilities. I'm a little kid. I can't defend myself against these grown men. So I'm worrying about getting hurt. So my issue now becomes just survival. Whatever I had to do to survive and make it through this, that's what I did. And I did a lot of foul and stupid stuff just to preserve myself, just to save my ass, for lack of a better word. Because back then, people, that molestation stuff was real. Back then, we had what they called booty bandits. HIV and AIDS kind of slowed that down. But yeah, they had guys walking around with jars of Vaseline in their pockets. And they would rape people. That's what they would do. So my biggest fear was not becoming one of those type of victims. So I had to learn how to survive real quick. I had to learn to think on my feet real quick. And I learned. I wasn't the toughest guy in the world, but I knew how to manipulate situations. And that's what I did. I knew. And the older guys kind of took a liking to me because there weren't a lot of kids in the prison system during that time. So as long as I listened to them, by not hanging out in the, on the basketball court, not getting high, not messing with the institutional alcohol, as long as I did those things and listened to him and stayed away from them, and got a job in the school, got my GED, became a college clerk, made me go to college. It's like, as long as I did those things, it kept the predators away. And that's what I had to do pretty much to survive. You know, I had to do what the older guys that looked out for me said do. And I didn't want to. Then when I got like 18, 19, I felt like I'm an adult now. I'm grown. I can do what I want to do. And I went through this phase of trying to act like I was tough because I had a life sentence. And needless to say, that didn't go well. That didn't go well. I got stabbed 17 times while I slept in the dormitory. Thought I was going to die. Fortunately, I didn't, but I really thought I was going to die when that took place. And then me being stupid, when I got out the hospital and got back, I felt like I had to get some get back. And I ended up getting stabbed again 2 weeks later. Being stupid, thinking I can go deal with something that I wasn't prepared to deal with. But that really gave me an eye-opener, made me realize that just because you have a life sentence doesn't make you tough. Some of these guys been fighting for breakfast every day at the daggone table, and here I am thinking I'm tough, been fighting all their life and in juvenile facilities. I haven't done any of that stuff. So I realized that I was above my head, and it made me start looking at ways I could change and become better, ways I can avoid stuff. And that really was a shift in my perception, a shift in my approach and my ability to function in the prison environment.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Anybody else have a question from that story? Anybody want to hop in?
I have a question. I'm sorry. Like who stopped you and for what? I mean, you said...
It's a kid story. All right. Now, initially, I started off at the penitentiary. I got out of the penitentiary and they sent me to the Maryland Correctional Institution in Hagerstown because they made a technical error. So it got me out of the penitentiary to a different environment where younger people were. When I get up there, I'm not eligible for any type of programming because I already had my GED. Back then, you had to be within 3 years of your release to get in vocational shop, to get in college, to get a preferred job, you had to be within 3 years of release. I got a life bit. I ain't even else parole for at least 7, 8, 9 more years. So it's like, I couldn't do anything. So I kept getting in trouble. Bad record initially. First 5, 6 years, I have a horrible record. Horrible record. Weapons, stabbings, fights, horrible record. Horrible record. So anyway, I'm on segregation. And the guys I called my walking partner, they got in a beef with a argument or a disagreement with another group of guys. And he ended up, my walking partner's co-defendant ended up stabbing a guy that everybody really liked. And he stabbed him because the guy had 3 separate additional bits, 3 5-year sentence for stabbing people. So his mindset was, why am I going to wait for this guy to stab me? So I'm going to stab him first. So when that took place, now things, because they didn't have gangs back then. People just, they clicked up like neighborhoods and stuff. So what ended up happening, they end up getting in a beef. My walking partner, his co-defendant, and this other group of people, they were beefing, real stabbing each other. They was doing all types of stuff. And I'm on lockup at the time. So when I come off lockup, all of them are on lockup. So they say, well, look, what are you going to do? The guys, they had the numbers, they out there. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to get involved in this? Are you not? I'm telling them, no, man, I ain't getting involved. I just came off lockup. I don't want no trouble. Y'all handle that. That's what I told them. But again, I'm thinking as a kid. I told them that so they would leave me alone. But I wrote what we call a kite, a little letter, and gave it to a kitchen worker to take to my walking partner. It got intercepted. Inside the letter, I said, man, look, this is what we're going to do. When you come off, I'm going to have the weapons. We're going to go straight at these guys. We're going to do all this stuff. So when the other group seen the letter, I became a threat. So that night, they targeted me in the dormitory. And they stabbed me 17 times. It's like, hey, it was stupid, but that's how things go.
I had a question. Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Claire.
Okay. So my question is about your story about how your childhood trauma and those child experiences led you, kind of contributed or fueled the fire that kind of was already there and that pushed you towards your rape charge. So my question has to do with how, I know that you don't have kids. Wait, do you have children that you did not assume?
No, I don't.
It got out 3 months ago. It's very unlikely. I mean, I don't know. But
people have babies in prison. So yes. I know a lot of people have children and it was in prison. Yes.
But how would you say is a good way to, from your experience, go about preventing young men or young boys from feeling that same insecurity that you felt at that time? As I'm asking this question actually more personally, because I have 2 younger siblings and I'm like the oldest and I'm a girl. So I do think about these things sometimes because I know that society is going to be tough on them. But I do, like, you know, if you had children, especially boys, how would you go about making sure that they don't end up in the same path that you did?
Now, let me flip it a little bit. As opposed to them being my children, I have counseled at-risk youth for like 10 years. I was being involved in a program called the Reason Straight Program. It was a flip side of scared straight, as opposed to just scaring people and trying to get people to see the horrible realities of prison. We sat and had counseling sessions where we talked about specific things relating to prison. And during this process, I ran into quite a few groups that had, like the Pegasus group at the Woodburn Center. It's in Baltimore, but kids who have deviated or have like sexual offenses. So what ended up happening, I would be able to talk to those groups specifically about my situation, or it could be another group that's unrelated, but similar situations. Because what I find is that everybody feels shame. Everybody feels fear. Everybody feels hurt. Those are normal things. But the idea is how we address those particular things. So when it comes to children, my position would be honest with yourself and be open to talk about different things. Everybody, because kids, sometimes when we kids, I know myself, I didn't care about anybody that was outside of my neighborhood. They weren't my relatives. They weren't my peers. They weren't the parents of my peers. They didn't come from my school or my church. I felt like I didn't have to care about them at all because they had no relevance in my life. And that dehumanization process allowed me to do a lot of things, because as kids, we were taught to go outside of our neighborhood to steal, go outside of our neighborhood to fight. We were taught that, and that was the stupidest thing in the world for us to get, because as we grow older, we foster or believe in those same things. So when it comes to children, that's the first thing I would try to teach them, is that we're all connected. Just because somebody doesn't look like you, just because they don't come from where you are, just because they don't share the same religious beliefs, it doesn't give you a right to be disrespectful or to harm them. They're human beings too. And this is something that I find today, the kids, they don't have that connection. They just don't care. They don't care. And they have to learn to care. If they care, they have a better chance of being successful. If they don't care about the next man, they are entitled to do whatever they want to do. They're entitled to it, and that's how they're going to think. So I don't know if that helped or not, but that would be my suggestion when it comes to that issue of children. We're all connected. They got to understand that.
Yeah, that was really insightful. Thank you.
Great. Does anybody else have another question, sort of bouncing off of that? There's a few folks we haven't heard from yet.
I have a question. My question is, how do you feel now after being incarcerated?
Last week.
Well, like, do you regret anything? Like, do you regret?
Oh, yes. I got major regrets. Major regrets. I regret being so scared that I didn't tell anybody what was going on with me at the time when I was a child. I regret being so cowardly and scared again for not taking a chance of just having sex with a neighborhood girl that really liked me, just because it could have been wonderful. I regret not taking that chance. I regret not caring about the victim in my case. I regret that because that was a human being too. That was somebody's mother, somebody's wife, somebody's sister. All right. That was a lady down the street, the lady that goes to church. That was somebody that had a right to be respected and treated a lot better than what I treated. And I really regret the harm that I caused her, the direct victims in my case, which be her, her husband, her family, her friends, her loved ones. I regret the harm and stuff that I caused my family, my loved ones, because they struggle with this through the whole time. They struggle with this same process. They went through a lot of horrors too. Then you got to look at the courts and the police. You got to look at all of these people impacted by the decision and crime I chose to do. So I do have regrets in that respect about what I've done and what I put other people through. I also have the regret of throwing away my life. I made the choice to do certain behaviors that got me stuck in here. And I regret doing that because there's so many things I missed out on. And so many things I now have to struggle with because of my incarceration. So I have plenty of regrets when it comes to issues like that. Now, recently, if I can, I went to last week, I went to Annapolis because I got involved in lobbying when I got out. I connected or joined the Maryland Alliance for Justice Reform, Correctional Education, a coalition. I joined these firms because on the inside, I would always write letters during the General Assembly, but I could never partake in it. The advocates used to get my letters, used to talk to me, keep me abreast of what was going on, because I have a real interest in criminal reform. So anyway, this particular bill I was telling you about, the Yes Act, I started off talking about that. So I did a written testimony. I did an oral testimony. I applied for the oral testimony. So I'm down there listening to this bill being proposed, and I'm listening to the senators. I'm listening to things that they're saying. And I didn't realize it then, but I'm feeling kind of angry. I'm feeling angry because people are taking a position, man, look, a 16, 17-year-old commits a violent crime and he goes to the juvenile system, he's going to be released at 21. They need to do more time than that. I'm saying, granted, in my mind, sometimes kids need to go to the adult system, but it shouldn't be automatic. It should start at the juvenile system and let the people who have the ability and clinical knowledge to make the decisions decide whether that case should go forward. Not the police officer, not the state's attorney, not the criminal court judges, because they don't have any background in child psychology, adolescent psychology. They don't have it. But I'm listening to them over and over, and I get pissed off because now my testimony come up. Instead of talking about the things that I had set up to talk about and I discussed with everybody else, I end up flipping the whole process. Now my argument is, I testified, I was a 15-year-old that got adjudicated in the adult system. I testified about all the trauma and stuff I experienced and other people were exposed to, but I attacked the senators, because I said it's absurd for you to say that on one hand, that because somebody commit a crime, that now because a kid commits a crime, he's now a miniature adult. He's now mature enough to deal with the adult system. However, at the same breath, you're saying that he can't vote, he can't enlist in the military, he can't enter a binding contract without parental consent, he can't buy tobacco, alcohol, or a firearm. He can't do all of these things that you recognize he's so immature to do. Why are you so quick to throw away a kid and put him in a situation where you know he's going to come out worse because they don't have the rehabilitative skills or interest to protect him and help him? Most of those guys that go to these situations, they get in bigger trouble. They come back. Recidivism is real big amongst youth that go to the adult system because they kind of messed up. They become worse. So because I attack them, that opened the door for the senators to attack me. And they felt appalled that instead of me coming and apologizing for my crimes, I'm attacking them. And it made me feel really, really small, because the issue was not about me apologizing for my crimes. The issue we were discussing was whether or not it is okay to automatically send a kid to the adult system if he committed a crime of violence. And it made me realize that I hadn't gotten over what happened to me. And this is 42 years ago. And I still feel some kind of way, and I never recognized that until I got in that particular situation. So my next therapy group, I had my mental health 101. That's something that I talked about. And it was amazing to me that I still harbored that resentment and that anger over what happened to me and what it subjected me to coming in the system.
Well, I think we've got time for about one more question. Thank you so much, Gordon.
No problem.
Does anybody have one more burning question they want to ask? If not, I've got a good one on backup, but I want to hear if any other fellows would like to hop in there. Claire, I see your camera's on. Are you you're thinking of one? No? No? Jasmine, maybe? Question? Nothing? Okay. Gordon, how did you find your faith?
Whoa. I don't know if you have a long enough story to do that.
As long as it takes.
In 80, short version, in 85 or 86, I got transferred to Tux Institution in 85. What ended up happening is that the place was so antiquated, the only time you could take photographs or pictures was once a month when they had like a function or a social activity. So the nearest one that came up was this thing they called Ramadan for the Sunni Muslims. All right. I wasn't Muslim. I was a staunch Christian, but I wanted those pictures. So I talked to a friend who said, well, you can go fast with us if you agree to the rules. So I agreed to the rules because I wanted the picture. I got in there and it was somebody named, nickname was Bumps Bilal, became a good friend of mine later on. His position was non-Muslims shouldn't participate in religious activity. It shouldn't be that. So because he had this contempt and hatred for me, I'm young, but I'm pretty intelligent. And he made me feel so small. I found ways to make him look small when he taught classes because he didn't know what he was teaching. He didn't know. So I would always raise my hand and shoot him a question and made him look stupid because he wasn't doing what he was supposed to do. Eventually, he got upset. He told the imam. The imam called me in the back of this little kitchen area, and he was getting ready to crucify me, for lack of a better word. But they gave me an option. I could walk out and leave and never come back because I'm not Muslim. It's not an obligation for me. Or I could sit at the table and participate in the class, but don't ask any questions. Of course, my initial reaction was, I'm not coming back. But I thought about the pictures, and they said, oh, I could sit there if I be quiet. So I changed my mind and sat there and was quiet, but it allowed me to start reading. And I read this particular book. It was called The Fundamentals of Islam. And it had a quote in there. Matter of fact, it wasn't. It was like 3 or 4 pages dealing with the concept of the inherent descent. Muslims don't believe in the concept of the inherent descent. They don't believe because Adam and Eve sinned, all men inherited that sin. We don't believe in that concept. So to me, I thought that was odd. And I said, man, these Muslims crazy as hell. How can they not believe in something that everybody believes? I came up Christian. Everybody knows it's Christian. This is a fundamental of the belief system. But over the next year, I started encountering problems that related specifically to that. A fight happened on the tier. They locked the whole tier down. One person abuses an appliance that they allow us to have. They take the appliances out to jail. Everybody got to suffer. Lobbying, they make the rules or laws more severe for people that's already in here. My parents come down, they gotta be subject to frisk search. Those things made me realize that maybe why is everybody suffering for something that one person done? So I began to question and doubt that. And that question and doubt is what led me to embrace Islam, because I could not be considered a Christian if I didn't believe in this fundamental principle, because to me, it would be no need. And they explained it. Why are you going to believe it's Jesus, God, and he died on the cross for your sins if you don't believe in her descent? So because I had that doubt, I had a reason to revisit my belief system, and I end up embracing Islam.
Did you end up getting the photograph?
Definitely got the photograph. And guess what? 2 years later, I became the imam. I became the imam at prisons throughout the state. I became the imam. I was really committed to learning and trying to be a better person, and Islam helped me with that. And because I was so dedicated and sincere, I ended up elevating myself amongst people who were really older than me. So for years, every place I went, I ended up becoming the imam or the assistant imam or education emir. That was just for years. It wasn't until maybe 6 or 7 years ago that I started backing out of positions because I needed to focus on getting out. And I start backing away from things. And it was a good break. It was a good break. Yeah.
I have a quick question about the social media right now. I mean, are you using them, Facebook, Instagram? Do you know something about them? And like, I mean, maybe you're struggling. And what do you think about them? Because back in 1979, there is...
I'm intimidated by social media. I do not deal with Facebook whatsoever. Matter of fact, I had a hard time dealing with this daggone iPhone they brought me when I got up. I didn't know. I have never used a cell phone in my life. Never. Now they give me a phone. I had to learn how to use it. My peers, other mates, we're having issues because they're going on social media. They're going on dating apps and all this stuff. One of them got catfished. One of them hit something he shouldn't have hit, and he took the money out of his account. So what the people at the Times organization did, they set up what they call a tech training program to help us utilize the phone, help us navigate through the internet, help us to put protections on our phones and little stuff like that. And helps out banking, online banking, establishing credit, resumes. It's like they really set up a good program to help us out because they didn't realize that was a problem for us. And it really helped us out.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we're about at our ending time here, unless anyone has any last remarks. Well, do I hear somebody? All right. Well, thank you so much, Gordon, for all the stories you shared with us.
Not a problem.
that hour that flew by.
Yeah. Well, I hope it will be helpful, because my role in life now is to really give back. Even though I focus on returning citizens, that's a big issue for me, that you still have to prevent other people from coming in here too. So I'm hoping that it'll help out in some way. And I'm an open book at this point. Now I'm 59 years old. I don't know how much long I'm going to be around. My thing is I'm trying to leave something that will help other people. So, and I appreciate the opportunity. I don't know if it ever come up again, but if it does, man, let me know. It's not a problem. I enjoy talking about my experience because I believe others can benefit from it. So thank you all.
Are you living in Baltimore?
Yes, actually I am. Actually I am. Yep.
Well, we will be in touch. We're going to take this interview and edit it as a group and talk about it. And there will be a premiere, I think, sometime in May. So we'll be in touch. And thank you so much. You've already shared so much with us.
All right, thank you. You all have a good night. And again, I apologize for being late. Family issues.
Not at all.
Be safe. Bye.
Bye-bye. Be safe.